And in your health today, teenagers and risky behaviors. A new survey from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reveals how high school students are handling everything from sunscreen to sex. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Lots of teenagers know that they're supposed to use sunscreen when they spend time outside, and many of them remember their parents slathering it on. But now that it's up to them, do they bother with it?
Not really.
No. I used a little bit yesterday, but not today.
I didn't bring any at all.
Does it surprise you that less than 10% of teenagers wear sunscreen in this country?
No.
The 10% figure comes from the CDC's latest survey on teen health behaviors and refers to the percentage who say they use it regularly. Seventh grader Alexa Zelliger is about to turn 13. She says lots of girls just want to be tan, even if it means getting a little sunburned.
You always want to make, like, the right decision, but then also you have, like, another rebellious side of you that, or just the side that, you know, it's kind of a social thing.
Going along with the crowd, Zelliger's teacher, Jason Rosenbaum, says it's a struggle for teenagers to think through all the possible consequences of their actions. In the case of sunscreen, the risk of skin cancer may seem too remote to be real.
The balance between immediate gratification and safety are definitely a struggle.
This holds true for all the decisions that teens go on to make about everything from alcohol and drugs to sex and tobacco. And the CDC's survey on teen behaviors covers them all. Every 2 years, researchers are able to get about 14,000 ninth to 12th graders from all over the country to weigh in on all of their most personal decisions and behaviors. Their responses are kept anonymous. Glenn Flores is a pediatrician and professor at the University of Texas Southwestern. He's reviewed the survey.
Teens constantly face temptations in every part of their life.
And in some spheres, teens are making good choices. Take, for example, tobacco use. It continues to decline among teenagers, though just slightly. About 1 in 4 students report using some kind of tobacco. In other ways, the CDC survey shows that many teens are still taking risks. Flores says, take sex, for example. The survey found 1 in 3 high school students are sexually active, and 61% of them report that either they or their partner use a condom. This is a slight decrease from the rate of condom use reported 2 years ago. Flores says for parents who are concerned by these statistics, evidence suggests that it makes good sense to talk early and often to your kids about sex.
There are studies that document that when a teen reports that they're able to talk to their parent about sexual issues and have good communication with their parent, that they're less likely to be sexually active and that they're more likely to use condoms if they're sexually active.
Flores says the reproductive health information that teens or preteens get in school seems to be important, too. Advocates for more comprehensive sex education say teens today just aren't getting enough facts. James Wagner is president of Advocates for Youth.
Right now, the best estimate we have is that around a third of school districts in this country now have an abstinence-only approach. Another third have kind of a mixed bag, that there may be some reference to condoms or birth control, but not a very systematic or comprehensive approach.
So it's the remaining third that are getting the comprehensive approach where abstinence and birth control hold equal sway. Wagner says without accurate information on both, the risks that young people are taking may increase. CDC officials say they're not sure why sexual activity rates are going up a little bit and condom use is going down a little bit after major gains in both categories in the 1990s. They do say if trends continue, they will get concerned. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
This is a bittersweet week for political junkies. The news that Hillary Clinton will most likely concede to Barack Obama means the end of the longest and one of the most entertaining primary seasons in history. So, We've collected some moments that perhaps didn't change the race, but certainly did entertain us along the way.
What should we be looking for in our next president? Certainly someone who is very, very, very old.
Three words. Vice President Oprah.
Not change you can believe in, it's change you can Xerox. And well, I just don't think. No, but you know, but Barack, it is. Because if you know, if you look.
Folks, I didn't major in math. I majored in miracles, and I still believe in those too.
Cut back, and we'll be back in our pre-September 11 mentality.
Pre-September 11 mentality.
Before September 11.
Before September 11.
A long time before September 11.
Rudy Giuliani, there's only three things he mentioned in a sentence, a noun and a verb and 9/11. I mean, there's nothing else. There's nothing else.
I don't think I'm that bad.
You're likable enough.
Thank you so much.
Give me a break. This whole thing is the biggest fairy tale I've ever seen.
Congress crew, Bush, Dub, Playa Cheney, Condoleezza, Rizice, and all the other haters. Juno Watt, Anchorage, Wirebanks, Watt MC, Gravella helicopter up in his house.
Hello, Democratic candidates. I've been growing concerned that global warming, the single most important issue to the snowmen of this country, is being neglected.
Did you see a UFO?
I did. It was an unidentified flying object, okay? It's like, it's unidentified. I saw something. Now.
Senator Clinton tried to spend $1 million on the Woodstock Concert Museum. I'm sure it was a cultural and pharmaceutical event. I was tied up at the time.
While I was working on those streets, watching those folks see their jobs shipped overseas, you were a corporate lawyer sitting on the board of Walmart.
I was fighting against those ideas when you were practicing law and representing your contributor, Resco, in his slum landlord business in inner city Chicago.
Y'all, there are three people in this debate, not two.
An important policy message from Governor Mike Huckabee.
My plan to secure the border? Two words. Chuck Norris.
I, Stephen Colbert, am officially announcing that I have decided to officially consider whether or not I will announce that I am running for President of the United States.
I'm wondering why there's a cardboard cutout of Mitt Romney behind me. But anyway, as I was saying,
I just want to reiterate for you the top 10 reasons I decided to get out of the race. Number 10, there weren't as many Osmonds as I had thought.
I understand what working folks go through. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this before, but my father was a mill worker.
It's 3 a.m. Something's happening in the world.
I'll rename the 10th month of the year Baroctober.
It's about being able to look your children in the eye. Or in my case, my children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, and great-great-great-grandchildren, the youngest of whom are nearing retirement.
Everybody in America wants to know how it's going to end.
Ready?
Chuck Norris approved.
That political cheap trick was produced by NPR's Robert Smith. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Rising food prices have sparked street protests in parts of the developing world, and in the U.S. prices are also rising, about 5% over last year, and for many Americans that means a different approach to grocery shopping. NPR's Elise Spiegel went shopping with three women to find out what's changed.
Anita Rhodes is a high school dropout who had a baby on her hip before her 20th birthday. But she's also a hard worker, someone clever with limited finances. And so until 4 months ago, she had never been inside her local Mennonite grocery. On the way to another store in her hometown of Oakland, Maryland, a rural community on the West Virginia border, Rhodes explained that the Mennonites sell damaged goods at basement prices.
The things there are way, way past their due date, but I tried it. Yes, I did.
Her first time out, Rhodes carried home a couple boxes of cereal she knew her kids would like, but it didn't work out well.
And opened one box and it had bugs in it. I mean, I took the box of cereal back and the lady that runs the store is very nice. She gave me my money back.
The box of cereal had cost around $1. Now, some people might not have bothered to retrieve a sum so small, but the math of Anita Rhodes' life doesn't permit that kind of luxury. Rhodes, who works as a mental health aide, is a single mom with three kids who makes $374 every 2 weeks. And so the recent spike in food prices has made what is normally a hard situation even more difficult.
I don't even look at roast right now, just because it's so expensive. I looked at a chuck roast, and it was $15.
But high food prices mean more than foregoing chuck roast. Rhodes goes down the list. No paper towels, no bottled water, no chips, no cookies, no candy, no toiletries of any kind. Her teenagers use toothpaste on their pimples. Wherever there is room to cut, Rhodes says, she cuts.
We used to eat 12 grain bread. We're back to white.
Still, there is a drawer of unpaid bills, and every visit to the store brings fresh reason for anxiety. Walking through a regular supermarket, Rhodes notes the almost weekly rise in the price of milk.
2 weeks ago, it was $3.39 a gallon, and then I think it was more Monday.
Today is Friday, and the price is $3.49. It's gone up again. Rhodes does not have a plan for what she will do if prices continue to rise, which stresses her out. Fortunately, her kids have been very understanding about the recent lifestyle cutbacks.
They try to make me feel good, like everything's okay, but I was a kid once, and I know there's things they want.
Still, Rhodes has no doubt that no matter how high food prices get, she will be able to provide for her family. She points out that she was raised in rural Maryland. She is, she says, a country girl.
I can shoot a deer. You know, I can do that. I can shoot a turkey. So I will feed my kids one way or the other.
What kind of cheese you have today?
3 hours away in Northern Virginia, Amanda Rudd stands in front of a refrigerated cheese bin at Costco. Rudd is a retired library administrator with small round diamonds in her ears. She says she started to become aware of the prices around February after sitting down and looking over a pile of store receipts.
I just said to myself one day at home by myself, I'm really going to have to watch what I buy. And so I think about what I buy, what I have at home, and what I can do because my retirement hasn't changed at all.
Because she's middle class, Rudd's cutbacks are not as dramatic as Rhodes. But she says every time she opens the refrigerator, she thinks about her finances.
I used to kind of toss food without, but now I don't want to toss anything. And some things I just virtually don't buy.
Rudd no longer carries home blueberries or strawberries. She is careful about the meat she buys. But perhaps one of the biggest changes in her life since February is the way she actually gets to the stores where she buys her food.
I don't get in the car and go as I used to, you know, just drive to one of them.
Instead, every Sunday, Rudd sits down with a stack of local papers and clips coupons from different stores, something she hasn't done since her early married life. Then, with the precision of a space shuttle engineering crew, she will plot out how best to organize her shopping. Today, she is at Costco because she must go to an appointment down the road. She will buy bananas, and that is all. Then she will make another stop at a giant grocer several blocks away.
I'm going to stop there for one item that they have that I want, and I'm going to stop there on my way up to the program today.
These are the changes Rhett has made so far, but she worries that if prices continue to rise, she might have to go back to work. And in some small ways, the cost of food has even touched some higher-income people.
Let's see, we have our spicy fried chicken, breaded wings, breaded chicken, breaded potatoes, breaded anything you can think of.
Diane Kraus is giving a tour of the prepared foods section of the Shoppers Food Warehouse in her Virginia neighborhood. The selection of foods under the hot lamps is very different from the prepared foods offered at her old grocery store. You see, until January, Kraus was an organics devotee who shopped at Whole Foods. Then she has what she refers to as her Whole Foods moment.
I went to Whole Foods because I needed a cake and groceries, and it was my daughter's 23rd birthday, so I wanted to get a luxurious cake, and I love Whole Foods for that.
Besides the cake, Kraus filled her cart with the usual items, the colorful fruit, fresh greens, and picture-perfect meats that she'd been taking home without thinking since the Whole Foods market opened in her community several years ago. Then she got to the checkout and did something that she hadn't done for a while.
And I started looking at the prices and what I was buying, and I realized I had $140 worth of food in the cart, and I didn't have three meals. And I realized I could not afford to shop there.
Now, no one was more shocked by this realization than Kraus herself. She didn't consider herself the kind of person who had to watch prices.
We have lived in an affluent neighborhood for the last 20 years. We have another house that we bought for cash on the Shenandoah River, and we own a building in Chantilly, which we also bought for cash. So I guess we're upper middle class.
Still, when Kraus got home, she started doing some math and discovered that she spent more than $300 a week feeding her family and that it was starting to stretch their budget. And so she decided to make some sacrifices, starting with one of the things she loved most.
Organic food. I won't buy it right now. It's just too expensive.
That's how Kraus ended up at the Shoppers. And Kraus says that she isn't the only person she knows who feels this way. She recalls a conversation that she had the previous weekend when she and a girlfriend were getting ready for a small vacation.
We were packing out to go away for the weekend, and my one friend had her Whole Foods bags full of clothes. And I said, well, you know, it's good to know you get another use out of the bags or whatever. She said, yeah, this is the last set. She said, we won't be buying these bags anymore. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, can't shop there anymore.
Kraus says she didn't push further. She knew exactly what her friend meant. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. This Saturday, Hillary Clinton will concede. Maybe. She's expected to congratulate Barack Obama on winning the Democratic nomination, but there have been mixed messages from Clinton's campaign, and she is not planning to release her delegates. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports.
Senator Clinton's behavior since Obama clinched the nomination has some of her strongest supporters worried that she is undermining Obama at a historic moment that should be his to savor. Congressman Charlie Rangel is the dean of Clinton's own state delegation in the House.
The New York congressional delegation are with her to the end. But we thought the end was the end.
The end, Rangel meant, was Tuesday night, when Clinton delivered what many Democrats are calling her less-than-gracious non-concession speech. To give you an idea how much anguish this has caused even her most loyal supporters, listen to Bill Galston, a former top aide in Bill Clinton's White House.
I was an early supporter and remained supportive of her candidacy as long as the candidacy was at stake. Having said that, how to put this? This is really hard for me. She's not doing either herself or Senator Obama any favors. About the worst thing you can do to a presidential nominee is to make him look weak. Americans will not vote for someone they perceive as weak, however much they agree with him.
Clinton has made it clear she wants to be vice president. Bill Clinton is pushing it in private, and in public, several of her top surrogates are mounting a campaign with her blessing. But the Clintons' aggressive angling for the VP slot may make it harder for Obama to agree to it, because it would create the impression he was succumbing to pressure, a decidedly unpresidential attribute. Also, an important quality of a vice president is to be a loyal number two, continuing to argue, as she did Tuesday night, that she's better prepared to be commander-in-chief and that she and her voters are the best way to reach 270 electoral votes is anything but vice presidential behavior. So says Jim Jordan, a Democratic strategist.
Lots of people who are close to her think she's earned it somehow. Well, I don't think most in our party believe that you earn or inherit that job. I think you're asked to take that job. And I think that the most important consideration in that selection isn't really electoral. I think they go to personal comfort and trust and a strong relationship.
Whether or not Clinton brings more votes than she takes away is unclear right now, but Obama can determine that through polling. And there are other factors that weigh against a so-called dream ticket. She undercuts Obama's message of change, and there's her husband, who, although he helped her in the campaign, also hurt her with repeated angry outbursts like the one this week when he unloaded about Todd Purdom, the author of a Vanity Fair article about him. He started out calling Purdom sleazy and dishonest and went on from there.
But he's a real slimy guy.
He didn't stop even after being reminded that Purdom was married to his former press secretary, Dee Dee Myers.
That's all right. He's still a scumbag.
And it's not just Bill Clinton's behavior. It's the fact that he's resisted releasing details of his business deals and the names of the multimillionaire donors to his presidential library. That and the awkwardness of having a former president back in the White House would make it even harder for Obama to put her on the ticket, even if he were inclined to do so. So now, the couple who until recently was the undisputed king and queen of the Democratic Party must ponder their futures. First on Hillary Clinton's to-do list is to work her heart out, as she has promised, to get Obama elected. That's the only way to begin to get back in the good graces of all segments of the party, particularly African Americans. Strategist Jim Jordan.
She is nothing if not a good Democrat. And the honest truth is her future depends on it. If it is ever suspected that she and her husband, out of spite or future ambition or for whatever reason, did less than their all to elect Obama, it would just reflect horribly badly on her and would end her future in politics.
And that future, if it doesn't include the vice presidency, could mean a spot on the Supreme Court, going back to the Senate to become a superstar legislator like Ted Kennedy, or planning another run in 2012. For Bill Clinton, the to-do list is short. Reburnish his ex-presidential brand, which has been tarnished by his behavior in the 2008 Democratic primaries. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Randolph College in Lynchburg, Virginia, has been making a rough transition from all women to co-ed. The administration and the alumnae are all fighting over financing. At the heart of that battle is the college's storied $100 million art collection. Now, all involved are awaiting a ruling by Virginia's highest court, which could decide what happens to that art and, as Joel Rose explains, profoundly impact the future of Randolph College.
The school was founded as Randolph-Macon Women's College, a name it kept until 2007 when it began admitting men. College officials say enrollment was falling and the school was in danger of losing its accreditation because it was spending money out of its endowment to compensate. The school's lawyer, Edward Feuer, says the trustees had no choice but to go co-ed.
It was important to make a change before it was too late. I mean, you could dig yourself so big a hole that you can never get out, and the college's board of trustees did not want to do that. And they did the smart thing and took action.
Action that infuriated many of the school's alumnae. Anya Stremski, class of 2005, runs a group called Preserve Educational Choice, which is fighting the co-ed decision in court. Stremski says the school is making its financial problems worse, with bad decisions intended to attract men.
They're building a $5 million track and field in the middle of campus this summer, with concession stands, a press box, grandstand, etc. Ironically, they don't have a track and field team, but I suppose they're going under the build it and they will come mindset. It's pretty clear they're trying to attract men to the institution.
But it wasn't just the decision to admit men that enraged the school's alumnae. What the college did next made national news. The trustees decided to sell paintings from the school's prized Mayer Museum of Art. College President John Klein says it was not an easy choice.
This selling of the four paintings has caused everyone some real serious depression. But we really feel that it is more important to help solve the college's financial problems and increase the endowment.
An endowment, critics point out, that currently stands at more than $150 million. Last fall, college officials announced their intention to raise at least $30 million more by selling four paintings at auction, including the centerpiece of the collection, The Men of the Docks by George Bellows. The alumnae filed another lawsuit, and they got an injunction that temporarily stopped the college from selling the paintings. But they had to shelve the suit when they couldn't come up with $1 million in bond money. The alumnae hope a win in the Virginia Supreme Court in the co-ed case will also protect the artwork. But college president John Klein thinks that's a stretch.
If those issues are related, I don't understand the reason why the plaintiffs spent a lot of money filing a separate lawsuit to enjoin the sale of the art.
When that suit was shelved, the college took one of the paintings from its collection to Christie's. The Troubadour by Rufino Tamayo sold last week for $7.2 million, a world record for a Latin American painting at auction. Art history professor Laura Katzman quit her job at Randolph-Macon last year over the school's decision to sell art.
It's starting to confirm our worst fears and nightmares that the college appears to be using the Mayer Museum as an ATM machine. Whenever there is a financial need for a new building, sell another painting. Need for a new dorm, sell another painting. Need for an athletic facility, sell a few paintings.
Katzman says selling artwork to pay bills is an obvious violation of ethical practices accepted by museums across the country. But Randolph College officials point out that the Mayer is not an accredited museum. And they say the sale is legal because the donors place no specific restrictions on the Tamayo or the three other paintings the school plans to sell. One of those paintings is from the Peaceable Kingdom series by self-taught artist Edward Hicks. It was donated to the school by Phyllis Crawford, class of 1920.
She'd be absolutely appalled of their selling it. I mean, this was more than just a cash gift. This was an act of love.
Peter Reinthaler is Crawford's nephew and the executor of her will. He says Crawford was never wealthy. She was a librarian and an author of children's books. Reinthaler says she used the proceeds from a literary award to buy the Hicks painting in 1938.
There are lots of times that she could have sold it for greater comfort for herself, but obviously did not, and she wanted to go to Randolph-Macon.
Reinthaler admits his aunt did not put any restrictions on her donation, but he says the college could have at least let him know they planned to sell it. If the Virginia Supreme Court's ruling, expected tomorrow, clears the way for the sale of more artwork, Reinthaler and other opponents say they'll look for another way to continue their fight. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
Mike Pesca, tell the truth. When's the last time you wore a necktie?
Had to have been, maybe a wedding, or actually, I think since then I was on some community access TV show and I dressed up for it.
So it is not frequent.
Very infrequent.
Very infrequent. Yes. You are not alone. According to a recent Gallup poll, the number of men who wear ties has been rapidly declining, and the number of men who wore ties every day to work last year dropped to a record low of 6%. That's according to this poll. The disappearance of the tie is especially bad news for tie makers, who this week closed down their industry trade group, the Men's Dress Furnishing Association. So is all this just bluster about nothing, or are we really seeing the end of the necktie? Marty Staff is the CEO of the men's clothing company JA Apparel, which owns the Joseph Aboud label. He is a former member of the Time Maker trade group, and he comes into the studio, and if to punctuate the point, is not wearing a tie.
That's correct.
Have you seen, is this the end of the tie? Is this the end of the necktie? Are we making a storm in a tea kettle or whatever that is?
10% of teapot is the idiom. Yes.
Well, no, I don't think so at all. We actually like the neckwear business, and my company has a big profitable business, which has really sustained itself. So we're pleased with that. But it is the end of the neckwear business as we've seen it for the last several decades.
How so?
Well, neckwear used to be really part of an obligatory uniform that men wore to the office as a matter of course. Over the last 10 years, America has become a much more casual workforce. And right now, 50% of American men rarely or never wear suits. So we've had a significant cultural change where men are just dressing down, and therefore ties become less important as part of a uniform than ever before.
Was there anything that happened culturally in society that triggered this kind of change, the shift to a more casual attitude in the workplace?
Yeah, I think when we look at guys 22 to 30 and we probe with them about how they dress, they recognize they need to wear a suit. And in some cases, it's empowering. They recognize they need to wear a shirt and a tie, but they don't want it to be they don't want to lose their ability to express themselves. So the necktie is just morphed into something different, where it becomes more of a fashion accessory, not unlike a scarf or a pocket square or an iPod case or than just a piece of silk or cotton around your neck as part of a uniform.
It used to be, I think, that there are certain industries where it's mandatory to wear a tie. Some of them still abide, like finance, high finance, probably a white shoe law firm. Are there fewer entire industries that are pretty requiring the necktie? Is that the case?
Sure. I mean, that's widespread. You know, I also think that, you know, being rich used to be defined only as having lots of money. I think now it's being defined as having lots of time, mm-hmm. or also having the ability to dress as you choose. You know, I worked with Calvin Klein for 10 years, and he would come into a room and everyone would be dressed in suits and shirts and ties, and he would come in wearing khaki pants and a t-shirt, and he looked like, and in fact was, the most powerful guy in the room.
Yeah, it's like the guys who are really at the top don't carry a cell phone, because that would make them really accessible. And it's almost the same thing where if you don't have anything to prove, then you don't have to wear a necktie.
I agree. But having said that, you know, I'm not wearing a tie today, but I am wearing sunglasses around my neck, and I did have a great umbrella, and I do have a great watch.
You look very nice, by the way. Nice jacket.
Oh, thanks. But I would wear a tie if I thought it would enhance my outfit. So when you dress up and you wear a great navy suit, if you wear a great silk, you know, a woven file tie, it's cool and it makes you look better. But just wearing a day-to-day burgundy tie as part of some dopey outfit doesn't make you smarter or better or more powerful. Just has no reason.
So the obligatory tie is the tie that's taken it on the chin.
That's exactly right. What the way I relate it is, America's had this dynamic auto industry, which over the last couple of decades has lost its ability to provide cars that are stylish and correct for the marketplace. So they're now changing. That's what we've done in the neckwear industry. We love narrow ties. We love colorful ties. We love very dressy ties. All we don't like are boring ties.
Mm-hmm.
So are more people using ties as an accessory? Like, are the ties getting really funky as a result of this?
They're getting to be like what pocket squares are. So we find at Joseph Aboud that men like to wear dress shirts in a sporty way and like to wear sport shirts in a dressy way. So a cool narrow tie with a denim shirt or a chambray shirt looks hot. You know, the fact that a great company like J. Crew, which historically has been very casual, is introducing neckwear, but in a casual way, is very telling to me. Just neckwear will now exist in a different way than it did before.
More than other politicians, Barack Obama is showing up in places without a tie, with a jacket and the open collared shirt. Will he be a trendsetter like maybe Kennedy was?
Well, I'm glad you said that. It's been widely reported, and we know that Barack Obama is a fan of Joseph Aboud and wears our suits.
Really?
Oh,
wow. Is that true? 100%
true.
By the way, we own a factory in Massachusetts, and people like John Kerry and Barney Frank make regular visits to get our clothes there. They buy them, I might say. But I think that for Barack, wearing great suits with an open shirt is going right after this 22 to 30-year-old age group, which dresses the same way. It looks very modern, and it doesn't look casual. It just looks modern.
Yeah, you're right. I think a few years ago, if a politician tried that, he would turn off voters.
Uh-huh.
And now Barack Obama, you don't hear too much complaints about it. That young kid without the necktie. Anyway,
I got one more question for you. I'm going to ask you to stick around after the break. We're talking with Marty Staff. He's the CEO of the men's clothing company JA Apparel, which owns the label Joseph Aboud. You are listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Come back. Hey there, welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. We are finishing our conversation with Marty Staff. He's the CEO of the men's clothing company JA Apparel, owns the Joseph Aboud label. He's a former member of the Tie Maker trade group that has shuttered its doors as of this week. Why? Because there are fewer men in America who are wearing neckties. We're talking to Marty about the consequences of that. And Mike asked you a question earlier. I want to repeat it. Are we seeing more ties in Europe than we are seeing in America? Is Europe still a place where men will sport a necktie? Yep. Almost any day?
Yep, absolutely. If you walk down the streets of Milan, you see men wonderfully dressed in neckwear. And in simple terms, it's because America has evolved into sort of a McDonald's theory of dressing. We'd rather get two cheap ones than one good one. And in Europe, men will wear a beautiful necktie over and over again, and it looks hot and it looks great, and it's very, very special. We just don't have that left here.
When you shutter a trade group, is there a lot of discussion? Is there a debate like, let's not give up on this? Or do you just say, we're wasting money and we're rowing against the tide? tried, and it's not worth it at this point.
I think the decision was made for itself. I mean, the apparel business is sort of like a shark. If it doesn't swim forward, it sinks. So we have to constantly change. So in the neckwear business, those that are doing well, and again, my company's doing well, are the ones that adapt to the modern consumer. But I think that in any industry, there are people who just think it's the same as it was in 1985, and it's not.
Now, you mentioned that you have a factory for suits in Massachusetts. That, the whole debate about the textile industry in the United States, and you keep hearing, just there will no longer be a textile industry in the United States, and those jobs are going overseas, and that's just the way of the world. You find the opposite is true for you?
Yeah, for us, our factory is the best single thing we have in the company. We employ about 600 people. We make 250,000 suits a year in our factory, and we provide them to the best stores in America. We would rather make exact amounts for every store than go to places like China or Mexico, which are low labor markets, but where if you need 10, you have to make 100. So we cut to order, and it's a very special business.
So maybe the textile industry in the U.S., the future is it has to be high-end, and it's just we won't have a mass-market textile industry in the United States, perhaps.
Well, in terms of finished goods, I'm not sure why we do well and others don't, but I can say we have a stable workforce. They're Portuguese people in New Bedford, Massachusetts. The factory's been in existence for 50 years, and the quality of product has been so good and acknowledged by the better stores in such a complete way that for us it works. I think if you opened a factory tomorrow, it would be unlikely you could easily succeed because you'd really have a lot of ramp-up work to do, but we've been doing it for 50 years now.
We focused a lot of the conversation on the new casualness. It's been building for a long time in the American workforce. As a man who's devoted many decades to the world of fashion, and men's fashion in particular, do you lament this change in American culture? Do you walk around the streets of New York and say, you people are a bunch of slobs. You need to straighten up, put on a necktie, tuck your shirt in, Mike Pesca?
Well, thank you for pointing out how old I am.
I'm sorry.
My father, God bless him, when he was 50 years old, he perceived himself as an old man. I'm in my 50s, and I still think that I'm the Abercrombie model. So I think it's a change in America right now. So, you know, men of my age and younger just think much younger than ever before.
Well,
so
if you wore an eye patch, you'd be the Arrow shirt model. That'd be cool.
Well, Arrow is a brand that's coming back, so, you know, that's not a bad thing. I mean, I will say I worked with Ralph Lauren for a long time, and Ralph is the king of neckwear. And in the late 60s, when he started, he did these very wide neckties that were very, very odd-looking at the time. If you go to stores now that carry Ralph Lauren products, they're very wide neckties, sort of reminiscent of the 60s, and they look great. So fashion comes and goes.
Indeed. And we will leave it at that. Marty Staff is the CEO of the men's clothing company JA Apparel, former member of the Tie Maker Trade Group.
And hey, he's not in that trade group
and
anymore.
He's not in that trade group.
There is no trade group.
There is anymore. No trade group. It shuttered its doors this week. Marty, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, guys. This was fun for me.
Giving us a little tie insight. We're going to take a few minutes now and get the latest news headlines from the BPP's Mark Garrison.